Joining us today is Professor Nicholas Johnson, retired University of Iowa law professor and actually an Iowa City native. He has worked on both coasts, having taught at the University of California in Berkeley, then became part of a Washington, D.C. law firm. While in D.C., he held three presidential appointments, one of the first of Lyndon B. Johnson's appointments as U.S. Maritime Administrator, also co-director of the Public Health Institute. Most notably, he was FCC Commissioner, that's Commissioner of the Federal Communications Commission under the Johnson administration. And by the way, he also really did get his picture on the cover of the Rolling Stone. Now back in Iowa City and retired from teaching law, he has served on the school board and continues to write on many subjects. You can find his work on his websites, columnsofdemocracy.com, fromdctoiowa.blogspot.com, and nicholasjohnson.org. Nicholas Johnson, welcome and thank you for joining us today.
Well, thank you. Pleased you asked.
This came about in part because of the events of January 6th and the events that took place on the U.S. Capitol and a lot of the commentary surrounding that. And you had talked about protecting democracy, and I had had questions about the use of both private and public internet and social media and the First Amendment. You had spoken about the need to defend democracy.
Well, that's a pretty good summary of where we might go. But before we get into that, I would like to say a word about KICI, because when I was on the Federal Communications Commission, which is actually an independent agency and not really a part of the executive branch, so I had a lot of independence there. And one of the things I noticed was that the American people really do not have a First Amendment right, individual citizens, in this way that we think about it, when it comes to mass media, newspapers, radio, television. That is to say, I am now being interviewed by you at your invitation, but I have no legal right to come to you and say, you must have an interview done with me. Similarly with the newspaper, I can submit a letter to the editor, or I can even go into the advertising department with copy, and I'm willing to pay their full price for. And they say, no, we're not going to take your ad. So you may be involved in the mass media as a citizen as a matter of grace by the owner of the outlet, whatever it may be, but you're not there as a matter of right. So I felt it would be helpful to have ways of getting more community voices on the air, and supported the idea of community radio from the beginning. Pacifica was one of the major operations back in my day. And then when we got into cable television, I insisted that we include in our regulations a requirement that cable companies make channels available to citizens in the community who could come in and make video and put it on the air. And so more recently, the commission proposed the idea of low-power community FM radio stations, and you were well-informed and energetic enough to go after one for Iowa City. And so while I very much enjoy the programming that you put on and have one of my radios in the house always tuned to KICI, it's also a little nostalgia and pride whenever I listen that I had at least something to do with trying to enable citizens to get their own voices out there in the community. So that's why I support KICI and why I urge others in your listening area to do the same. You've got programming that's simply not available anywhere else on the commercial stations or even Iowa Public Radio. And whenever I tune in for a minute or for an hour, most of the time I find something that I find really interesting or kind of peps me up for the day. So I didn't want this opportunity to go by without saying a word about that.
Well, thank you. And I think a lot of listeners weren't aware of the role that you played in making such local institutions possible. But thank you, and thank you for the recommendation. And I'm glad you enjoy our programming. And we try to create a nice mix of programs. I wanted to go back to something you said earlier about the First Amendment, and that individuals don't just have the right to walk into a media outlet and demand to be published or heard. But I also wanted to bring up the question of the fourth estate, or the idea that responsible media is detached or aloof or non-partial in some way, and so they're not at the beck and call of just anybody who walks in the door. It seems like there is a balance of power there, or do you have other thoughts on this?
Well, no, your thoughts are my thoughts. I wrote a book toward the beginning of the Trump administration where I predicted fairly accurately, as it has turned out, the evolution that we were undergoing in this country. I called the book Columns of Democracy because my approach was that there are certain institutions that one has to have and maintain and treat with respect and recognition in order to build a democracy on top of them. And one of the most important is the one you mentioned, which is free and independent mass media. And some of the others are, you need an educated population. Mm-hmm. Originally, we set up the schools to provide civic education. That was the idea behind it in the 18th, 19th, and early 20th century. We do less civics training now than we used to, but that's still very important. Funding libraries. Mm-hmm. Schools, higher education, public education, and of course, voting rights. Mm-hmm. So that anything that results in disparaging the media and trying to reduce the public's willingness to accept it and recognize it as important in a democracy, when you attack the media and say it's fake news and that media are the enemy of the people and so forth, that's a blow against democracy. That is not patriotic. That ruins, causes to crumble one of the major pillars of democracy. The same is true when the legislature or a local community fails to adequately provide for the funding and availability for free of K-12 public education, community colleges, higher education. Those states that have provided that free have found that it returns many times over what taxpayers put into it in terms of economic growth. But when you don't adequately fund education, that's a blow against democracy. Clearly, anything designed to suppress the vote, to make it more difficult for people to vote, strikes at the heart of a democracy, a representative democracy, which is what we have, because we don't have a direct democracy like they do in town meetings in New England. Mm-hmm. We vote for representatives who are supposed to represent us. Well, how can they represent us if we've been denied the right to vote? Mm-hmm. Or how can we trust the system if we're told that it was a rigged election and somebody who won in a landslide, but in fact they really didn't, and that there's no evidence of it and there's no documentation of it, and all the courts that are approached with this allegation have thrown the cases out, and all the Republican and Democratic officials swear that it's been an honest election. Well, that strikes at the heart of an election. And, of course, that rouses up people who think that their candidate won in a landslide and has been denied the office. But that's a terrible blow to a democracy. And that's why I've been thinking about the idea of treating democracy as something that ought to have legal rights of its own. And what do I mean by that? Well, there was a famous article, a years ago called Do Trees Have Standing? That is to say, should a tree be able to appear in court in its own right? Now, obviously, that's going to be filed by a lawyer, just like a lawsuit by you or me would be filed on our behalf by a lawyer. And then there's a TED Talk up now about how water, whether river or lake or whatever, ought to be able to sue in its own right. And so I'm playing with the idea that, for example, defamation, when you ruin somebody's reputation by telling falsities about them, lying about them, putting on information you know is not true, and it harms their reputation. Well, you can get damages for that as an individual. But now recently, I think it's called Dominion, the company that made these machines to count papered ballots. And the folks have been arguing that, they were the ones that really screwed up the elections. And what? There's no evidence to back that up. And it's harmed the company. And the company has brought a defamation action. Not in the name of the owners of the company or the employees, but in the name of the corporation. The corporation was defamed, even though it's not a human. And so I'm suggesting if we're thinking about legal rights for trees and water and corporations, I don't see why we can't do that for a democracy. And when someone attacks the judiciary, you need an honest and independent judiciary, or attacks the media, or attacks the results of an election by using false facts. And I make that distinction. I'm not talking about opinions. I'm saying when they say something that is simply not true, there's no evidence to back it up, and it causes harm to our democracy, as clearly happened on January 6th. That the democracy ought to be able to sue in its own name. And obviously, I haven't polished that up yet, and I suspect a lot of my colleagues in the legal education business would enjoy a big chuckle about that idea and go on to read the next page of the newspaper. But anyhow, something that we got to do something like that. But there are these columns to democracy, and there is a process that an authoritarian wannabe goes through in order to become an authoritarian strongman dictator of a country. And we've seen this throughout Eastern Europe and the attempts of Vladimir Putin worldwide to try to do as much harm to as many democracies as possible. And we always believe, well, it never can happen in America. Well, it can. You can have somebody who goes after the media, goes after the judiciary, criticizes educators, engages in suppression of voters' rights. Ultimately, it ends up with what we saw on January 6th. I think that's something that ought to be legally recognized.
Well, that's an interesting concept. It does bring to question, you are differentiating between outright lies and falsehoods and something like a Saturday Night Live satire sketch. But where do you draw the line? People who are legitimately deceived, or whether there are real questions? Some of what you say sounds to me like lèse majesté, that you can't make fun of certain, or you can't insult certain things. And I think people are concerned that if that line is drawn too tightly, that could actually be used to suppress legitimate dissent. And I will mention, you talk about the voting machines. I know I'm not supposed to air my own opinion, but this one is pretty much generally understood. Paper ballots are really the fail-safe for any voting machine company, because machines can fail, and so verifiable paper ballots are generally considered the solution to that. So I'm wondering, what is your solution to the question of how far do we go? How do you prove damages? Where do you draw the line?
Well, for starters, I would rely on the law of defamation. And it is not defamatory to express an opinion. You're not stating a fact. You can say, I don't like House member so-and-so, or there's that old song, I just don't like her, I'll think of a reason later. That's not defamatory. So you can ridicule, you can express opinions. That doesn't enter the era of defamation. Just to set the record straight, Dominion makes the point that what it is doing is counting paper ballots. So there is no opportunity for Dominion to do anything to manipulate the outcome, and then you have a hand count later.
Right.
So the people criticizing that company were saying things that simply were not true. Defamation means you are saying something that is simply not true, and it's demonstrably not true. And any reasonable person would know that it was not true. And you knew that it was not true. And you did it in order to disparage the reputation of a person or a corporation, or in my case, democracy itself. You're trying to destroy a nation's democracy by repeating information that is false. That qualifies as defamation. And that's not squelching Saturday Night Live. It's not squelching right-wing radio talk hosts who express opinions. It simply deals with people who are deliberately lying. They know they're lying. They know they're causing harm as a result. They want to cause that harm. They want to produce results that they could not produce if they had to stick with the truth. That's what we call defamation. So I don't think there's any harm to come out of that. Now, if it's questionable and you can't prove whether it's true or false and so forth, you've got those problems. But in the case of what we've witnessed since November 3rd, those were expressions of fact that were demonstrably and unanimously understood to be false representations and designed to do damage, and that did do damage.
Mm-hmm. So are you saying this is something akin to yelling fire in a crowded theater when there's no fire?
Yeah. Yeah, if you want to use that one.
That's a pretty simplistic overview. But as I had mentioned, I had been reading on several different opinions and people concerned about using these events to justify greater surveillance, greater police presence, and most notably, and I'd be interested in your thoughts on this, access to the internet and use of social media. There's already concern about social media policing. I'd be curious of your commentary on something like that.
Okay, well, we got three issues going here, and I'd like to separate them out.
Sure.
First of all, the risks of surveillance, that really has nothing to do with what I was saying about defamation, okay? Totally separate, yeah. I mean, protecting people's reputations through the law of defamation is totally disassociated from governmental surveillance of the citizenry. And so then we've got the question of whether concern about domestic terrorism, like concern about foreign terrorism in the United States, can lead to a sometimes a public demand for more surveillance, more
right.
vigorous, you know, a question of how could January 6th have occurred? I mean, people were tracking what these groups were saying, knowing what they planned. They had been listening to Trump before he won the Electoral College in 2016, saying that the elections were going to be rigged, trying to destroy people's respect for the honesty and virtually no fraud involved in American elections. So he had been building up throughout his term, and it intensified after November 3rd with this assertion that he had, in fact, won by hundreds of thousands of votes, won in a landslide, and it was all due to corruption on the part of election officials and so forth. So that is also very separate from a defamation, is that issue. And then what you were saying about with the violence that comes out and demands that we prevent things like January 6th, that that tends to open up the possibility of greater surveillance of all citizens, innocent citizens, mm-hmm. in order to find out what is going on here in our own country amongst those who are prepared to bring down our government and put people in office who, in fact, have not won elections. And is there a possibility of danger in that? Yes, there is. But it's a balance. It's very difficult to remain totally free of any government knowledge of what you're up to, and at the same mm-hmm. time prevent these violent acts. And that's a tough balance. And so far, we've done pretty well compared with other totalitarian countries with preserving individual citizen privacy, but mm-hmm. with technology, there's more and more invasion, obviously. And then the issue that you next raised after all those was the matter of social media mm-hmm. and what are we going to do with it? Well, now you're going to get another little mini lecture here.
Okay.
Because spoiler alert, when I get to the end, you'll discover that I don't have the answer. I think it is really complex, and mm-hmm. I'm struggling with it. And at some point, I'll play around with it in a blog post and then turn it into a Gazette column if I can come up with anything that's really helpful. But lawyers like to think in terms of analogies. And so the automobile comes along, and you say, well, it's a horseless carriage, so it's sort of like carriages pulled by horses, but it doesn't have any horses. And so maybe it should operate under the same rules of the road that we had for the buggies, all right? So in what is the social media? You see, what prior category can we put it in? And it doesn't really belong anywhere. That's the problem. I think we've got to, as they say in the theater, take it from the top and just start all over and try to figure out what is it we want of these social media and how are we going to provide it. Now, one of the models is, take a newspaper. We've already established no citizen has a right to have their material appear in the newspaper. The newspaper totally controls it. They can put into the newspaper whatever, and this is ultimately the publisher, because the reporter doesn't have any First Amendment rights either. They can be censored by the owner. They can be fired, whatever. So the owner can have in the paper whatever the owner wants. The owner can keep out of the paper whatever the owner wants. In exchange for that, the owner is responsible for the content. So that if I am interviewed by the Press Citizen and in the course of that interview I defame one of the city council members, I can be sued, of course, but so can the paper because it repeated what I said.
I'm going to break in here because we're almost out of time, and this sounds like something that would be fun to have you back to talk about specifically. There are so many cans of worms that could be opened here and more questions to come, but with limited time, what I'd like to do is invite you back and hope you can talk about this in the near future.
Well, that would be fine.
Great. We've been talking with Nicholas Johnson. Under the Johnson administration, he was the FCC commissioner, Federal Communications Commission commissioner. He is a retired University of Iowa law professor, former school board member in Iowa City, and he currently writes. He's written a book called Columns of Democracy, which was predicting quite accurately the events and circumstances leading up to the January 6th set of events in Washington, D.C. You can also find his work on his websites at columnsofdemocracy.com, fromdctoiowa.blogspot.com, and nicholasjohnson.org. Nicholas Johnson, thank you for joining us today.
Well, thank you so much, Holly.